Judiciary Committee come to order. It is just a minute after 1:30 on Monday, March the 1st, 2010. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Egan is here, Senator Coghill, myself, Senator French. We expect Senator Wilikowski any moment. However, we have four bills up, and we don't want to waste anybody's time. So we will skip from, we've got Senate Bill 209, Senate Bill 260, Senate Bill 244, and Senate Bill 239, all on the docket today. I understand we're waiting for a witness on Senate Bill 209, and since Senate Bill 260 is also from Senator Menard's office, there seems no harm in taking it up first. So why don't we do that? Senator Menard, welcome to the committee. It's so nice to have you here. And Mr. Rovito, or whomsoever you wish to have with you for the bill, I'll turn it over to you and let you conduct the presentation as you see fit.
Thank you very much. And for the record, I am Senator Linda Menard from District G.
Welcome. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Senate Bill 260 puts in statute the ability for telephone or electronic corporates to allow members to vote electronic transmission as specified by the co-op's bylaws. The bill was filed at the urging of the co-ops around the state. Currently, co-op members may only vote in person or via the Postal Service. This method, however, is outdated and could be having a negative impact on members' participation in elections and other important matters. By allowing telephone and electronic co-ops to permit voting via electronic transmission approved in its bylaws, the legislature would make it so common the 21st century practices may be applied to important public information involvement matters. There is a zero fiscal note with this bill. The co-ops in every corner of Alaska will be enthused. The legislature has had the foresight to pass legislation important to their public process. The bill does not make electronic transmission voting mandatory, and co-ops choose whether they want to partake or not. Already, however, MTA, Matanuska Telephone Association members have voted to adopt this new law by allowing electronic transmissions voting. All MTA and other co-ops need is for the legislature to amend the statutes to allow these co-ops to do so. Bill Steiner from Chugach Electric is here in person today to answer any specific questions you might have about electronic transmission voting or this bill. Please help me in facilitating the quick passage of Senate Bill 260.
Senator Menard,
I believe there's many other letters of support from the different.
Good. I have seen this bill in a previous committee, so I'm fairly familiar and comfortable with it. Questions from members of the committee for this bill sponsor or her able staff? Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just a brief explanation of how the bylaws might look under these conditions. I'm supposing that was a question heard in previous committee.
I'll turn to the bill sponsor. Questions for how that you heard the senator's question?
Yes, I did not get that question at a previous meeting. And would you, Bill could probably be here. He's.
I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Just, I don't want to take a whole bunch of time.
No. Yep.
Okay, good question.
Nothing but time. Anything else from you, Senator Menard, or Mr. Rovito?
No, I'm just excited that, you know, we want to encourage people all the time to vote as often as they can, especially when they belong to these co-ops, and this is one more venue that we currently don't have in statutes, and I think it's, like I said earlier, getting in the 21st century.
Sure, and I think the key, at least for me, is that it's permissive. It's not mandatory. It's absolutely up to the co-op. Yep. Thanks so much. Let's turn to Phil Steyer, who is here, and from the Chugach Electric Association. Welcome to the committee, and we'd be happy to hear your thoughts on the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Chugach is supportive of Senate Bill 260 and very appreciative of the bill sponsor taking the lead on it to get it before you today. The key things about the bill are on the first page of the bill, and that is that, as noted, this bill adds an option to what is currently allowed in state statute. No co-op would be forced to offer electronic voting unless the members of that cooperative felt it was the right thing to do, because the bylaws would need to be amended to allow it, and bylaws are amended when members vote to do it. The senator mentioned that Matanuska Telephone Association has already amended its bylaws. I would note that Chugach members have already voted to amend the Chugach bylaws to permit this. And I would point out the as specified by the cooperative phrase in that is intended to allow a cooperative to define what works for that cooperative in terms of electronic transmission. Electronic transmission, arguably, is a pretty broad topic. I will tell you at Chugach, what we have in mind is to allow members to vote via the internet. Other co-ops might have some different electronic transmission in mind that might work for them. At Chugach, that is the method that we're considering. But that phrase is intended then to allow a cooperative that decides to engage in this to define election procedures that work for that organization. So we have spent a fair amount of time within the Alaska Power Association group. That's, for those who may not know, that's our statewide trade association for electric utilities, many members of which are cooperatives. And we've spent a fair amount of time in that group sort of talking this out and getting to language that's before you today that's supported by a number of letters, language that all the different cooperatives that were engaged in that discussion felt was appropriate, that each could then be supportive of it.
Thank you, Mr. Steyer. Question from Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I really don't have any other questions. I know that locally they have to do this, but we've considered that in a variety of different forums in the legislature as well, and so some of it was a little selfish in asking, because I know when we get to the executive committee part, that gets real testy, and I know that that's probably going to be something they're going to have to cross over at the electronic voting. And so, no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's stop for a moment and welcome Senator Wilikowski to the committee. We are on Senate Bill 260. Mr. Steyer, maybe you can just tell me what it takes to change a co-op's bylaws. What percentage of the membership has to vote? Do you have to be present to make that happen? I mean, just tell me a little bit about that.
We amend bylaws by putting a ballot issue before the members. Most traditionally, it's done in the spring of the year when we're having the election for directors to the cooperative. Things are amended by a plurality. So when more members have to vote in favor of it than against it. And when this was put to a vote of the members, it was in 2001, so I don't recall exactly what, yeah, it was pretty foresighted. I don't recall exactly what the vote totals were, but it was, you know, two-thirds, one-third, or three-fourths, one-fourth. It was a pretty significant majority.
I'm actually very glad to hear you say that, because I'm a Chugach member, and I was straining my memory to think when I cast this vote, if it missed me, if you'd somehow put it over on me, and it's probably fair to say that I don't remember casting the vote back in 2001.
I can appreciate that. I do have an answer to Senator Coghill's question.
Please go ahead, and then Senator Wilikowski has a question. Go ahead.
Through the chair, the senator had asked what the language in the bylaws might look like. I will say I can only speak for Chugach's bylaws, but today, Chugach's bylaws, if you were to look at the voting section, you would find that our language in our bylaws mirrors what's in AS 1025. So when it comes to voting, you know, our bylaws currently say basically a member may not vote by proxy but may vote, if the bylaws so provide, by mail. So we have that very very similar language in our bylaws today, and our bylaws then go on to specify that, you know, there's actually quite a lengthy section about how balloting gets done in our elections, and that we'll mail out a ballot packet a certain minimum number of days in advance consistent with the statute, and that the board is entitled to set a record date consistent with state statute for that election. So if this were to pass, we would basically move then to consider, and this I believe is an important part, to consider whether this is something that Chugach can assure itself can be done securely, right, before we would engage in it. And that's really a key point. We're in favor of changing state law to allow this, but as I said before, no co-op, including Chugach, should engage in electronic voting unless they can assure themselves that they can have as secure a process as today we assure ourselves we have through mail and in-person voting. So sure. It's sequential, one thing at a time, and this is the first step for us.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for coming in late. And Two questions. Question one, and maybe this was talked about, I was on security. And how confident are you that the security procedures exist to do this in a safe manner? Did I miss that?
No.
Through the chair, Senator, we have not taken a step to say, yes, we're doing it, and here's the vendor we're using. But short of that, we have had prospective vendors come in, pitch us on the idea of hiring them to conduct these elections. There are at least two, I believe, that we have visited with. I have called a couple of cooperatives in the lower 48 that do electronic voting, and I basically asked them sort of three questions. Has it increased voter turnout? Do you find that more younger voters in particular are participating? And thirdly, have you had any problems? Unfortunately, I haven't gotten particularly enlightening answers to my first two questions, but the two I have spoken with have both said they've had no problems with the election process.
And just one other question, slightly different area. I don't know if this would be best addressed by you or the sponsor. Does this bill, would this bill allow a co-op to have elections solely by electronic transmission? The way I read it, it says by mail or electronic transmission. And if so, I guess I would have some concerns over that because I know I have a lot of people in my district, for instance, who don't have computers and don't have access to computers.
Through the chair, I believe the way the statute is written, you know, this all evolved over time. So when Chugach began, for instance, in 1948, the common way to vote was in person. And for a long time, that's how all voting was done, was in person. And then, I think about the 1980s, the statute was amended by the words, may vote if the bylaws so provide by mail. I know when I went to work for Chugach in 1987, it was the first year that we had conducted an election in which we offered the option of voting by mail. So I suspect it was sometime in the 1980s that statute was amended in that way. So if you look at it, people can vote in person, and if the bylaw is so allowed, by mail. And now that we've jumped forward 20-some years in time and this new option of electronic voting is available, the statute is, we're asking the statute be amended to allow that technology as well. But I don't believe any of that, as I read it, takes away from your ability to vote in person or by mail.
And I guess that's, I mean, you say that, I was just thinking, coming to the same sort of thought myself, which would be, you know, would it be clearer to say by mail or electronic transmission or some combination thereof, as specified by the cooperative, to make clear that you could choose to have a ballot conducted by mail simultaneously with a electronic balloting and keep track as carefully as, you know, through some other method of who's actually voted by one method or the other. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just reading the language of this, the proposed language, I could see a co-op wanting to save money and say, we're just going to do it by email or electronic means, nix the mail, and if you can come in person, you can vote electronically. And again, I would just have that concern for the people that don't have access there.
Good question. Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I want to thank Senator Menard for introducing this legislation. I think if Alaskans can file electronically for their permanent fund dividend checks online, it seems to me like the cooperatives that want to participate in this new technology will be able to figure out the parameters and allow people to cast their ballots in this nature. I guess the thing that really pleases me that not only are the larger co-ops enthused about this, also smaller cooperatives around the state are also interested in doing this as well. And I appreciate you filing legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, very good point. I mean, the support is quite strong, as the sponsor pointed out. MEA, GVEA, AVEC, Alaska Power Association, all MTA, all weighed in favor. Anything else from you, Mr. Steyer, while you're here?
No, Senator.
Thank you so much. What we'll do is we'll hold this over to the next hearing to consider whether we just want to add a couple words in there to make clear as possible that you can vote by a combination of methods. But it seems like a bill that the committee likes, and I know I like it. We'll bring it up in the next hearing, and so thank you so much. We are ready to move to the next bill. Are you, Senator Menard, ready to go, or would you prefer to wait for Mr. Brown? Very good. We'll just go on down then to Senate Bill 244, the Governor's Duty Station. I see a representative from Senator Stedman's office. And we have a sponsor here as well, and a co-sponsor. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. And I believe Senator Egan was prepared
to make the presentation. Welcome to the committee. Thank you. Glad to have you here.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I can just say
wherever you're comfortable, absolutely.
Okay with you. I'll just reread the sponsor statement, and Darwin Peterson from Senator Stedman's office is here to answer questions. But Senate Bill 244 is going to clarify state law regarding the governor's duty station and travel allowance. Currently in statute, there are no provisions that require the governor to reside in the capital city and occupy the governor's duties or the governor's mansion during his or her term of office. This bill specifies that the governor's duty station, defined as the location where the governor spends the majority of his time and assigned to fulfill the duties of office, is considered to be Juneau. The proposed law does not prohibit the governor from maintaining a personal residence in another part of the state, but if he does choose to reside there and not in the governor's mansion, he will not be entitled to a travel allowance when away from the capital. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will defer to Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Senator Egan. Questions of Mr. Peterson about the general intent of the bill. I know we do have someone here from the department that sort of oversees travel reimbursement admin, and we can bear down into the details there if we so desire. This is a bill I heard in Senate State Affairs, so many of the initial questions I had about the bill have been answered there, but I want to make sure it gets a full hearing in this committee as well. Senator Coghill.
I'll have some questions for the administration just on some of the procedural issues.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions? Senator Wilikowski.
And I think Senator Egan answered. This says you can still live wherever you want if you're the governor. You just, even during session, if you wanted, you just couldn't get per diem for that. That's pretty much all this bill does.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Yes, you're correct, and you're also mistaken in a little bit in the sense that it's not per diem necessarily. It's travel allowance, which the Alaska Administrative Manual separates those two. There's meals and incidentals, and then there's overnight travel allowance.
So, because this issue has come up, I've had some calls from people. Does this require? So, but this does not require the governor to live in Juneau, for instance, or the lieutenant governor.
Through the chair, Senator, no. It just codifies in statute that Juneau is the governor's duty station. So basically the worst thing that could happen to the governor if he or she chose not to reside in Juneau and make the capital their home would be possibly the basis of a complaint by the public. So short of actually going in and changing the Constitution and make living in Juneau a requirement of holding the office, there's really nothing else we could do to the governor, but it is making it very clear in statute that the legislature intends for Juneau to be the governor's duty station, because currently in statute there is no duty station outlined for the governor.
Could you just explain to me how someone could file a complaint if we pass this bill against the governor for not living in Juneau?
To the chair, Senator Wilikowski, according to legislative legal in the drafting of this legislation, because obviously that was a concern of the drafter, the failure to make Juneau the governor's duty station would amount to a misuse of official position, and that could be the basis of a complaint, and then it would be up to the executive ethics branch to determine. Other than that, the other options would be recall or impeachment. recall in statute AS 1545.510 spells out the grounds for recall, which include lack of fitness, incompetence, neglect of duties, or corruption. So failure to make Juneau the governor's duty station would not be an offense eligible for recall. But and then impeachment, the legislature has the power to impeach all civil officers, but that's a pretty high bar, and we don't anticipate that a two-thirds vote in both the Senate and the House would occur based on an offense such as this if this legislation passed.
So what would the offense, I've always understood this to be, you live outside of Juneau, you don't get paid for it, for your travel. But you're saying this, we're sort of getting into the ethics of where you live? I mean,
Correct, through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski. We had two options in drafting this legislation. One was to amend the Executive Ethics Act, and the other was to amend the statutes in AS 44 relating to the duties of the governor. And attacking those statutes was difficult, primarily because changing the qualifications for the governorship would require a constitutional amendment. So amendments to the Ethics Act was our other option, and so in the Governor's Ethics Act, it would make it mandatory that the governor's duty station is Juneau. And this is the version that's in front of the committee.
Senator Coghill.
So in trying to figure out what a complaint would look like, what is the tipping point of percentage of time spent within the capital city that becomes the violation?
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, I would defer that question to the administration when they, because I'm sure they have a policy set out. Every administrative employee has a duty station, an official duty station, except the governor and lieutenant governor. So if I may, I defer that question to the administration. I'm sure they have a policy for that.
Senator Wilikowski,
does the legislature have a duty station? Do you know?
Through the Chair, no, this question actually came up in the last committee of referral, and it is an interesting question. The legislature, the legislators do not have an official duty station. During session, Juneau is where the Capitol resides, so if you didn't show up for work and there was a call in the House, then the authorities would be sent out to bring you into Juneau. But no, legislators don't have an official duty station.
Further questions for the representative or the sponsor? I don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's turn to Kevin Brooks, who is here as well and can maybe delve a little bit more deeply into the fine and intricate details of duty stations, per diem, and travel costs. Welcome, Mr. Brooks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration.
Good, thank you.
There was the question that came up regarding duty station. As Mr. Peterson pointed out, every position in the budget actually has a duty station, and it's the city where the person spends a majority of the time. Now, it was suggested that there's a policy on that, and I quite frankly, I'm sitting here thinking of, and I can't think of one, but what the bill says in plain language is that where the governor spends a major portion of time assigned to fulfill the duties of the office. That's in Section 2. I guess you could interpret that to be a simple majority. Is that, is it 188 days? I don't know. But I don't think you'd find something in writing that would specifically define a majority or a major portion of the time.
Let me ask this. What are the duty stations of the commissioners? Are those defined?
Mr. Chairman, they are defined, actually. There's three in Juneau. I believe there's 9 or 10 in Anchorage and a couple in Fairbanks. But there, if you went to the budget detail, you would see a specific location associated with each of those duties.
This is set by budget and not by statute?
Correct.
I see. So it's just done by the administration submits their budget?
Correct.
I see.
I'm sorry if I may.
Go ahead. Yeah, please.
As it is with any other position, I mean, you do see a fair amount of position movement. I know I've had a history where I worked with Fish and Game for a while, and we often move positions, fish and wildlife technicians and so forth between cities. So it's not that uncommon for positions to move or change duty station. And it's usually done on an annual basis when you're building that budget.
And are duty stations typically set by statute or via the budget?
It's not a statutory, it's more of a, I guess, a management prerogative, if you will. Where do you need those resources? Now, I will also say that a majority of the permanent full-time positions are pretty static. They don't move. I just wanted to give you some perspective that there is some movement of positions, and it's not that unusual, but I'd say a majority of the 15,000 or 15,000 to 17,000 positions in the executive branch probably have a fairly static duty station.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the sentiment. I think that the fact that we supply a mansion and all that, but I'm concerned that what we're going to do is we're going to say the governor belongs to Juneau and not to Alaska. I want the office to be centered here. I agree, it's the capital. That's the place where it should happen. But if they spend a lot of time in Nome or Fairbanks or Bethel, wherever, and for some reason or another, it tips over to the 52% where he's actually out working with people, doing things. I'm concerned. I understand that's his duty. I like the idea of saying if you're going to use your home as a residence that you can't travel out of there, and I have some questions about that. But I was just concerned that if we're actually going to ask them to represent the people of Alaska and then say you can't go to Alaska, except for 49.5% of the time. You just wonder about the ethics of that. And so that's why I was asking, and I haven't settled on my mind how to get there. It may be we'll be able to find a language that says that it would be official, office duties or something like that that emanate out of this. But I don't know if I like that language yet.
I think there's a good discussion happening here, and what I'm thinking for the time being is to maybe focus on the financial impacts on this bill is in front of us, I think, because of some citizen unhappiness over the financial impacts and how this played out in the recent past. So let's talk about how this bill would address that issue, and then we may have to reserve to a future hearing a discussion about where the ethics charges may come in, and we may have to work with our alleged legal folks to get a view of how dangerous this provision is with respect to an ethics charge that you're spending too much time in the state of Alaska traveling around. I share your concern about that, so thank you for bringing that point up. Mr. Brooks, maybe you could just walk us through what payments to the governor would be allowed and which would be disallowed for a traveling governor under the adoption of this statute.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, the bill specifically addresses lodging allowance. So if a governor is traveling away from Juneau, as I understand it, was staying in a residence, maybe they had in a different part of the state, they would not be eligible for a lodging allowance. And really, that's the current practice. We only reimburse lodging allowances for invoices from a hotel or, other establishment where you might stay the night. But we don't, the state, as a rule, doesn't pay for lodging unless presented with an invoice. So that's current practice as well as what would be the case under the bill.
So let me just make sure on page 2, there's a reference in line 2 to travel allowance, and then and then on line 9, there's a reference to a lodging allowance. Maybe you can just tell us what the difference is between those two payments.
Well, the travel allowance is a broader definition, I guess. It might encompass every cost that you might incur when you take a trip.
Airfare,
taxi. Meals, taxis, those kinds of
That's
things.
That's the overarching category.
Right. And so that would be anything that you, and in the state, you claim a travel reimbursement there's a form, as you might expect, a travel authorization form, and so any claim for a reimbursement is submitted on a form, and you would attach your receipts to that. So the bill doesn't get at, say, a meal allowance, which is what, if I travel or you travel, we're all away from our duty station, we're entitled to a meal allowance as well as reimbursement for actual lodging costs. And so really, as currently written, it specifies and is very specific to the lodging allowance portion of that travel allowance.
When staying in the personal residence. And do you have to submit, so for any lodging allowance right now, you'd have to submit a receipt for to be paid for that. That's correct?
Correct.
And what about for a meal allowance?
A meal allowance is paid, your travel typically has a start and stop date, and it's $60 per day for meals and incidentals. And it's prorated on the day, a day of travel. When you depart or come back, it's prorated based on your time of, how long you were in travel status on that day.
Specifically, do you have to submit a receipt to be granted a meal allowance?
The claim, Mr. Chairman, the claim is submitted on that travel authorization form, so it makes it a consistent way of for state agencies to submit those claims, but you'd find it on that form, and it would specify days and hours and travel status and number of days times $60, and you'd come up with a meal allowance portion of the travel allowance in that manner.
So an employee, a state employee, up to including the governor, does not have to keep track of the receipts from their meals. They just basically tote up the number of days and prorate it by the, the partial days on either end of the travel, and you get paid $60 in essence per day for meals.
That's correct. You're not accumulating receipts related to meals. That's correct.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So who determines what the governor's, where the governor or lieutenant governor's duty station is under current law?
Well, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the way it's currently set up, we have the administrative manual, Alaska administrative manual. Mm-hmm. It's online at our website. I have the travel portion of it here with me today. And that's really, it's the rules that govern travel for all executive branch employees. And we interact in the department administration with each department's administrative services. And they process the bills, the travel, the contracts for their department. And so we interact with Gov's admin. They have an admin services there just like Fish and Game does or Commerce or any other department. And so it's their Director of Administrative Services that kind of sets the policy for their department and how they're going to do things, the timeliness of submitting receipts. But the admin manual is kind of the overarching rules by which state employees travel, if you will.
So I may just have a couple follow-ups, Mr. Chair. So under current law, I'm looking at page 60.3 in this manual that you provided us, and it says duty station is essentially where the traveler spends the major portion of their working time. So just to use the most recent example, the former governor spent the major portion of her working time in Wasilla and determined that was her duty station. Is that accurate?
Through the chair and Senator Wilkowski, I quite honestly, I don't know what the determination, I think the determination with the governor's office was that the governor's duty station was Juneau. But that probably would be a better question asked of their Gov's admin, the staff there. But I think that was the basis to my understanding.
So if the governor's, so if the under we pass this law and we're saying the governor's duty station is in Juneau, and somebody decides they want to live at their home in North Pole, then they would be able to get per diem or travel allowance for that time that they spend there still under this law.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, they would be entitled to a meal allowance. Meals and incidentals at $60 a day, but not lodging costs.
So,
that's current law as well as proposed.
At their home in Barrow, North Pole, Anchorage, whatever, they would under this proposed law, they would still be able to get per diem or travel allowance.
The meal allowance.
Meal allowance.
The meal. It's important to be that specific. I don't mean to belabor it.
I appreciate it. It's good for us to focus on the right.
And a couple points worth making, too. An individual has to submit the claim. It's not automatically given, if you will, and this was a point that was raised in the previous committee where we discussed it. Another point in some of the genesis, because this rule has been around for a long time. Certainly it predated the previous governor. And the rationale was, or at least part of the rationale, I would say, to be more specific, is... If if an individual is traveling and they have, and say, you know, they have a home in North Pole, in the example that you use, but their duty station is Juneau and they're traveling in North Pole, we would pay them if they went and stayed in a hotel. We'd reimburse the hotel and we'd give them meals too. So if they have a home available to them and they're willing to stay there, it actually would save the state that lodging cost. But you're still recognizing that they're away from home. They have to, you know, maybe they eat out, maybe they have to go shop and buy food, but there's some cost to them because they're away from, you know, where they're currently calling home. But the availability of lodging could actually save the state money. And so there was some recognition of that when these policies were formulated at some time in the past.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cogill.
I'm beginning to like this talk about North Pole. Governor from North Pole. Well, let's just say that the governor did have his home in North Pole like I do, and the duty station being Juneau, you go and do an event, you know, a military event, say at Eielson, you spend the night at home, but then the next meeting you have to go to is Washington, D.C., so you fly to Anchorage and get on a plane and go. The way this law talks, it sounds like the travel is only reimbursed from the duty station, not from the place that they are currently leaving from. And if that's the case, then we have to reword this, I think, because I don't think, but that's what it sounds like to me, and I'm open to suggestion. But that was one of the procedural questions I had, because we're saying that the calculation of the travel allowance during the governor's term has to be dealt with where the duty station is. And I think that we might end up creating a problem there, both economically and ethically.
Mr. Brooks?
Through the chair, and Senator Cogill, I would say the rules contemplate starting and stopping travel, or you know, a leg that might take you to one place and you depart from there and go to another place, and I think the administrative manual is certainly capable of handling those kinds of situations without, you know, harming a traveler out of pocket or unduly rewarding them for leaving from a different place. I'm trying to think of a circumstance of how that might be, but I think the policies that are in place certainly address those, because we've encountered just about everything under the sun with the number of people traveling on state business, you know,
from different locations.
There's personal deviations. There's all kinds of things like
that.
I
just want to make sure that this statute is in line with that kind of thinking. And when I read it, it didn't seem that clear to me. So I'll be pondering that.
Well, as a co-sponsor, I'll jump in and say it seems pretty clear that all it's saying, you know, the real meat of the bill, I believe, is on lines 8, 9, and 10 of page 2. And it's basically saying you're no longer going to get a lodging allowance mm-hmm. when staying in your personal residence while you're away from, you know, Juneau. That's what I'm reading it as. It doesn't say you can't be compensated to travel from your residence to Juneau or your residence to Washington, your residence to Eielson if it's just down the street. But that's the way I'm reading it.
And Mr. Chairman, I agree with that part. And I was just taking B is the operative language, and then sub 1 is the place that it would bounce off of. And I must confess I hadn't studied it to that degree just before the meeting, but it was a question that occurred to me as I was hearing the testimony.
I think it's good. It's good dialogue. It's good to flesh it out. Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, just a fundamental question. Does the governor get per diem? Like we get per diem when we're down here. Does the governor get a per diem similar to that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, no.
And just another question. So looking at the lines that Senator French just mentioned on page 2, line 8 through 10, it says cannot claim travel allowance, cannot claim lodging allowance, but you're saying they still could claim meal allowance. So that's something that we may want to change.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, again, just, you know, I won't belabor it, but it is important to read it exactly as it's there. The governor's not entitled to and may not claim as a travel allowance a lodging allowance.
And I think just to reiterate what Mr. Brooks has said before, while you could claim a meal allowance, that's voluntary.
It's not as if you're going to audit, like we automatically get checks for the days we're here for per diem. The governor doesn't automatically get a check for a meal allowance when away from the duty station. That's something you have to submit to be reimbursed for, just like every other state employee.
That's accurate.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that brings up another issue with me. So I understand the meal, but what happens if the governor goes and stays at a Days Inn or the Millennium instead of at his residence or her residence?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, we would reimburse the actual lodging costs based on a receipt from the Days Inn or the Residence Inn. Or
right, and that's the sort of the paradox that Mr. Brooks keeps bringing up. And at some point in the last hearing, a phrase we've all heard many times popped out, which is, you know, at some level you've got to let your conscience be your guide. And it's hard to at some level avoid that central sort of operative instruction. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. So question came up when the sponsor was testifying, and could someone file an ethics complaint on this if someone decided their governor, they want to live in let's say Anchorage this time, could someone file an ethics complaint based on your reading of the personnel rules? Or
Through the chair, and Senator Wilkowski, without reading that, I think we've seen anyone can file anything they care to.
But if they said, well, valid,
I mean,
if
it's sustained enough,
did you win?
I don't know what basis there would be, but
I think it's a great question. I'm going to pose that to Ledge Legal so we get a feel for, you know, what we're setting a governor up for passing the statute. I think it's a fair question, but I don't know that anybody here can give us a good, strong answer. It's worth exploring. Further questions about the sort of dollars and cents issues for Mr. Brooks? Don't see any. Thanks so much for being here. I appreciate your testimony. We will hold the bill over, and let me just check and see if there's anybody else in the room that wants to testify about SB 244. Anybody online? Thank you so much. With that, we'll close public testimony, hold the bill over for a little more legal analysis, thank you very much. We will turn back up the calendar to SB 209, but before we do that, we'll let anyone who may be waiting that the sponsor of SB 239, the Ignition Interlock Bill, has asked that be held over. They are in a little bit of a bind for their witnesses, so we are going to turn up the calendar to SB 209, State Council on Arts Regulations. We're back again to Senator Menard. Still nice to have you here. Welcome back. You know the drill. Put yourself in the
Thank screen. You once again. My name is Senator Linda Menard from District G, and I'm grateful that I can come up here and present Senate Bill 209. Senate Bill 209 will provide the Alaska State Council on the Arts the authority to adopt regulations relating to its statutory powers and duties. The bill has been introduced at the request of the Alaska State Council on the Arts, which is the last frontier state art agency, created over 40 years ago. Several of the Council's programs are governed by regulations, which the Council has followed and updated over the years. Recently, the Arts Council has sought to improve and streamline its grant-making policies, procedures, and regulations. In the course of this effort, the Council was informed by the Department of Law that it technically does not have the authority or statutory authority to adopt regulations under the Administration's Procedures Acts. While this legal opinion is at odds with their long-standing practice, the Council considered and took it seriously the advice of the Attorney General's office and determined the best way to rectify the current situation is to amend its enabling statute to allow its explicit statutory authority to adopt regulations. This legislation will, in essence, codify existing practice and will enable the Alaska State Council on the Arts to continue to administer and oversee its existing programs. Any and all regulations adopted in the future will have to comply with the review of public notice provisions of the Administrative Procedures Act. This bill has a zero fiscal note and will help the Alaska State Council on the Arts to continue performing its long-standing mission of helping more Alaskans appreciate, create,
and enjoy the arts, and having regulatory authority will directly contribute to the Alaska State Councils on the Arts' ability to do so. I have in the audience with me today Ben Brown. He is the chair of the State Council, to answer any specific questions you might have. And I believe, Mr. Chairman, you also have on the phone Charlotte Fox. She's the executive director of the council, and Rebecca Hatton with the Department of Law. And I know that I'll go ahead and open it up to questions.
Thank you, Senator Menard. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Can you just explain fundamentally the structure of the Alaska State Council on the Arts? Appointed by the governor?
Yes, it is the governor's appointments on their boards, and it comes under the National Endowment of the Arts, too. So that's federal, of course. And like we our intent in this bill is to get it so that we are in line with regulatory revisions when, in fact, we need or we deem it necessary to streamline what we're doing, what the Arts Council is doing. They still have to adhere to the Administrative Procurement Act, Procedures Act, and so.
So, and, Senator Wilkowski.
And I'm just, and I guess, like you have the Workers' Compensation Board, for instance, they develop their own regulations. They do it through the Department of Labor, I guess.
Yes.
Under this bill, would they do it through some state department or division, or they just go out and do it on their own, or how exactly do you envision it?
I think I'm going to ask Ben Brown to come forward before I dig a hole here.
You've done great so far, Senator.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Brown is here, and Senator Menard is correct. We also have Rebecca Hatton online from the Department of Law, Charlotte Fox from the State Council to answer questions, but we do have Mr. Brown, who's well-versed and well-knowledgeable. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, and I want to thank you for your indulgence in moving this around on the committee schedule. I had an unforeseen appearance across the street on behalf of a client, and I needed to be there, and so thanks for letting me do that.
Glad to do it.
As far as Senator Wilkowski's question, we're a standalone agency within the Department of Education, along with the Commission on Post-Secondary Education and the Professional Teaching Practices Commission. And we have a wonderful staff of hardworking, talented state employees who do the day-to-day work of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. And so, the Arts Council staff would be the ones doing the drafting of the regulations and then going through the normal hoops with the Department of Law, and if they get far enough, with Lieutenant Governor's office. And Ms. Fox can probably speak to this in greater detail, but the way we knew we had a problem necessitating this bill was efforts to streamline our grants. It's probably one of the best known functions of the State Council. We grant money that we get from the National Endowment for the Arts and the state legislature to arts organizations. Outnor Theater, Perseverance Theater, Anchorage Concert Association, Fairbanks Drama Association. And as a council, we wanted to increase efficiency for the grant applicants and for our staff, and we saw that people were coming back asking for small amounts of money too frequently. We were able to streamline a lot of those procedures in our policies, but some of them were actually ensconced in state regulations. And when Ms. Fox proposed to our Assistant Attorney General, Neil Slotnick, at the time, we're ready to have these reviewed, Mr. Slotnick looked at our enabling statute and said, hold it right there, you don't technically have the authority to do this. And so, we would not involve the Department of Education Commissioner's Office staff in this. It's something that our small, hardworking staff at the State Council would be able to do on its own up until it needed to get involved with other branches of the state government.
Further questions for Mr. Brown? I note that your letter points out that you have been told by the Department of Law you don't have the authority to adopt regulations. You have been doing so for many years. While the technical lack of authority came to your attention, members of the State Council weighed your options and decided that simply adding the missing language from the statute was the best way to remedy the situation. I think that's wise. Senator Wilkowski.
So when you adopt regulations now, do you have an attorney in the AG's office that works with you in helping to craft those things? Do you have like policies and procedures in place to deal with the AG's office? How do you do it now?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, yes. I mean, Charlotte knows that when she drafts something up, we have to run it by an assistant attorney general who's assigned to us. Ms. Hatton is now that assistant attorney general. She was brought on board to the Department of Law after the problem arose, so to speak, so it's something that she inherited. But Mr. Slotnick, who's been with the Department of Law for many, many years, is the one who had been looking at the regulations substantively when the procedural problem of our not having the ability to do what we were trying to do came to his attention. But then there's also Deborah Baer and Steve Weaver, who do just regulatory review as well. And it would go, so all regs would go through all the same hoops as any other proposed regulations.
Okay. And go ahead. And I used to work for the Department of Labor. I used to work with Deb Baer, and so she doesn't want anything to get by unless it's pinpoint. So if you're working with her now, then obviously you're doing it the right way. I'm just curious, is someone online from the Department of Law?
Department of Law, Rebecca Hatton. Ms. Hatton, can you hear me? Are you there?
Hello, yes, I can.
Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, and Senator Wilikowski has a question for you.
Certainly. For the record, my name is Rebecca Hatton, and I'm an attorney in the Department of Law.
Hi, Rebecca. Bill Wilikowski. Is this common? I know there are departments and divisions that have this regulatory authority, and is this would this be unusual to sort of branch this out to a council like this, or is this fairly common in the state structure of government?
Respectfully, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it's not uncommon at all. In the state, there are two types of councils. There are advisory and non-advisory councils that actually have the authority to promulgate regulations. And just off the top of my head, I can think of half a dozen councils, from the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, Police Standards Council, the Fire Council. I could go on. There are many non-advisory councils that promulgate their own regulations.
Learn something new every day. Thank you.
Likewise. Yeah. Further questions for Ms. Hatton while we have her on the line? Don't see her. Thanks so much for being available.
You're welcome, sir.
Charlotte Fox, can you hear me?
Yes, Chair. This is Charlotte Fox with the Alaska State Council on the Arts.
Welcome to the committee. I don't see a specific question for you, but I just want to check in to see if there's anything you want to add to the conversation we've had so far on SB 209.
Mr. Chair, Ben Brown's done an excellent job, as usual, representing us. I will say that it, as you can imagine, was a bit of a surprise that we did not have the statutory authority to promulgate regulations, since we had been operating under our regulations for many, many years. So I'm really glad that Senator Menard sponsored this legislation so we can get this cleared up.
Thanks so much, Ms. Fox. Any questions?
Maybe this would
go to
council, but what happens to all the regulations that have been passed without statutory authorization?
Mr. Brown?
I'll take a stab at that.
Sure.
Well, we don't really know, but I envision we're going to re-promulgate them all, and everyone will have one more chance to look at them, and so it'll just be a little extra transparency and openness, a little more work. But we've actually conferred with Ms. Hatton, and we don't think it's going to result in a discrete incremental charge. It's not going to cost any more money than anyone doing his or her job with the state already would have. But it'll be a little more work, but that's fine, because it just gets us kind of out there in the public eye a little bit more, and it's a chance to publicize some of the changes we're making to our grant program.
You go back and basically readopt them all at some point.
Exactly, Mr. Chairman.
Wonderful. Further questions for any of the good witnesses we have here? Don't hear or see any. Anyone else in the room who'd like to testify about SB 209? Anyone else online? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. This is the last committee referral for the bill, so we'll let it rest for a hearing and then bring it up at the next possible time and move it along. I think it's got good support from the committee. Thanks so much for being here. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.